Welcome to the South Cars Conference number 96140. Connection established.
No animals were harmed in the making of this podcast.
Good evening. This is the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. I'm doing the VOIP preamble. This is South Cars, the South Coast Amateur Radio Service. This TNT open forum is conducted under the guidelines of the South Cars organization and further follows the rules outlined in FCC Part 97 and Good Amateur Practice. This SCARS server is supplied by the West Michigan privately owned repeater network. This TNT net is conducted to provide information pursuant to amateur radio subjects and or other areas of general interest to the participants. All are encouraged to participate and ask questions of your guest speakers or speaker. Information regarding our HF operation may be found at www.southcars.com and for our digital operation at www.voip.southcars.com. Your moderator for this evening is KD0CDQ Mike. I'm located in Olathe, Kansas, which is about 23 miles southwest of Kansas City, the last I looked. And the temperature here now is 18 degrees, and we have 6 inches of snow on the ground. And I did have to get out there and plow that snow 3 times today, because, again, my wife is having some guests over this evening, and, of course, the driveway and the walk and the steps, everything's got to be pristine. So hopefully it is. Before starting, may I ask if there is there any emergency traffic or anything out of the ordinary that needs to be handled before we proceed? Okay, this evening, the subject matter will be the origins of ham. I hunted around the Internet, and I found a lot of information about ham radio, and I tried to find things that would be of interest to us. Some of these things may be commonplace for some of you, and then a lot of it is things we've forgotten. Either way, it'll be fun tonight, I believe. I'm going to let it drop. Thank you for that little early intermission. I had to get my dog team together and get everybody taken care of so they wouldn't be making any noise. Yeah, we got the dogs underhand now, I believe. Starting with the origins of ham, I looked up some things to see, you know, we all have ideas where ham, H-A-M, came from, and I found some things on the Internet that are interesting. The popular use, the real explanation, appears to be lost in the mist of time, is what I found on the Internet. There's a number of theories, some more plausible than others. Here's one that was quite prevalent at one time. Maybe Gordon or some other people may remember this one. I'm not quite sure. It really goes back there. The one we really like to hear the most about is Little Station Ham, H-A-M. This is how it goes. In the early days of radio, the government didn't assign call letters to amateurs. They just made up their own. Supposedly, 3 students at Harvard named Hyman, Almay, and Murray set up a station. They decided to use their initials as the call. Thus, we have the Little Station Ham. When the Navy tried to grab control of all radio frequencies, these guys are supposed to have testified before Congress, and the story of the Little Station Ham supposedly didn't leave a dry eye in the House. The press is supposed to have picked up on the story of Little Station Ham, and amateurs have been known as hams ever since. Unfortunately for this story, none of it checks out. A past president of the ARRL did extensive research in an attempt to confirm this story. There is nothing in the congressional record about Little Station Ham. There is nothing in contemporary press records. And there is no record of Hyman, Almay, and Murray at Harvard at the time this supposedly happened. This story first surfaced in an amateur publication in 1948 and doesn't seem likely to die. But it appears to have no factual basis. There's other things where they say where the ham might have come from. Another story you may hear is that ham is a result of a Cockney pronunciation of am, amateur. Amateur with the H in the front of it, I can't do that too well. But that is unlikely for two reasons. First, the term was used in America before there was a substantial amateur activity in Britain. And second, voice transmission wasn't used by amateurs of the era. So how did a pronunciation get propagated by Morse? So it doesn't seem like the Cockney accent that brought IM to the world. Another story you may hear is that it comes from a landline telegraph insult. Many operators of the day came from the landline background. And on the landlines, a common insult was that someone was ham-fisted in his sending. It is possible that commercial operators used this slang to refer to amateurs, and it caught on. That kind of is the one that a lot of us seem to go by, that hams with our heavy fist is where that came from. Letting it drop, this is KD0CDQ. Now here's one that I had to read a couple of times to understand. Then it came to me. I understood what they were saying. So maybe you have to listen to this a little closely. Certainly the term LID, L-I-D, came from landline telegraph slang. LID was a reference of the use of a tobacco can lid on a sounder to aid a poor operator in copying Morse. This one may be true. It wouldn't be the first time that a group adopted a term originally meant as an insult to serve as a slang term for ourselves. Now, originally the lid, this is from WA0DC. He says his grandfather was a railroad telegrapher. He said that the term lid came from operators who would put the lid of a Prince Albert tobacco tin can, I remember those little Prince Albert cans, tobacco tin can, on the sounder so they could copy the code easier. It was a practice that was frowned on by operators who did not have to do this, and it became the slang used for bad operators. It was also said that such operators had a tin ear. Now, tin ear, I've heard of that. We've all heard of people having a tin ear. And on the Internet, some more about those cans, about the lid operators. It isn't a lid. It's the can itself that works. The tobacco can was shaped similar to a pocket flask. You know, the little can looked like a pocket flask, but had a lid top that was made of metal on top of it. If you removed the lid and stuck the can in between the sounder and the reflecting box, then it amplified the sound, and it became a little rounder tone. It removed some of the clicking sound. Some of the local old-timers tell me they would fill the tobacco can with sand, varying the depth of the sand, to change the tone. So that's probably real, and that's probably where the term tin ear came from as well. This brings us to single sideband suppression carrier. It was frequently used in the early days. This brings us to the point where SSB began to become common in amateur communication. Numerous homebrew transmitters and receiver adapters were described in the amateur literature, followed by manufactured equipment. Early SSB efforts all used separate receivers and transmitters, and we all know that. The first SSB transmitter and matching pair receiver transmitter sets for the amateur market did not appear until the late 1950s, says the Internet. It was a Cosmophone 35, the Collins KWM1 and KWM2, and the Collins S-Line, etc. SSB operation concentrated on 75 and 20 meters in the post-World War II years because they were the most crowded phone lines allocated to ham. And 40 had no phone ban, and 15 wasn't a ham ban until the early 1950s. The main reason SSB was not more widely adopted by hams in the 30s was costly and complex. In the years, in the late 1940s and 50, QST had a regular column called On the Air with Single Sideband. There were SSB handbooks for hams put out by several publishers, and there were gripes that QST was becoming too technical and AWRL was focusing SSB, forcing it down the throat of the hams. See, the more things change, the more they stay the same. This is KD0CDQ, letting it drop. Anybody have a comment? Come on aboard. This is KD0CDQ on the TNT, on the South Cars Network. We're talking about the origins of ham, different sayings. And now I found a funny thing about, you know, the hi-hi, how we say on the radio as a laugh. Hi-hi is the Morse equivalent of a laugh. As in Morse, it sounds like someone chuckling. And for some reason, you really have to listen to it when you're sending Morse to appreciate its laugh-like sound. It is most commonly used on CW, but has carried over to voice as well. Many CW expressions have carried over to voice, such as 73, which is best regards, and 88, which is love and kisses, and others. The origin probably dates back before radio to the telegraph days. And since hams used Morse long before voice became practical, the sound of the Morse character's hi-hi was used to resemble a laughing sound. In some sense, it is equivalent to a smile. It's omnitopic. That means that the thing is actually sounds very much like the sound of real life. The definition was originally found in Dodger's The Telegraph Instructor Manual. It was around 1850 to 1900. I don't think any of us had that book. It was kind of early. However, I have never been able to find a copy of this document, says the writer. Wish I could. It would help to see the transition from telegraph to radio usage. So that is the best guess that this writer has. And based on what old-timers have said, it may be so. Another use of hi-hi in sending a greeting to a fellow ham was when vehicles passed. Now, here's a cool thing. When vehicles would pass, one driver would give four short horn beeps, beep, 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 followed by two short horn beeps, beep, beep. Since many hams had ham license plates, a fellow ham is easy to spot because of the mobile antennas, this might have been a cool thing maybe back in the 40s and 50s and so. I don't hear many hams beeping as they go past. They sound pretty cool. I think if I beep another ham here, I would probably get the international greeting sign. They wouldn't understand what I was doing. But we never know. If anybody has a comment, come on aboard. This is KD0CDQ, letting it drop. Here's another term that we hear now and again. Jury rig. We've all heard the term jury rig. We probably heard it, and it just came to us that what it meant because as children we heard it so often. Jury rig is based on one word, jury, J-U-R-Y, which is a nautical sense meaning makeshift, temporary. Well, one would rig, referring to a ship's sails and masts. The first known example of a jury is the compound jury mast, a temporary mast put up to brace one that has been broken or lost. Attesting since the early 17th century, they would use the word jury mast. A jury rig, then, is a temporary or makeshift rigging, and the verb is used figuratively in a sense to assemble or array hastily in a makeshift manner. The origin of the word jury is not certain, but some scholars identify it from Ori, which is I-U-W-E-R-E, a late Middle English word meaning help or aid, and borrowed from the Old French, a jury. And maybe that's A-J-U-R-I-E. Maybe Pete can attest to that. And maybe that's where the word injury comes from.
Let me Google that real quick. I'll come right back to you.
Thank you, Pete. Didn't mean to put you on the spot. I don't know any French, so when I see a jury, I don't know if it's a jour. I don't know how to really pronounce it. But I'll go on from jury rig on to something else we know quite a bit about. That's the origins of RG, as in RG58 coaxial cable. Okay, the RG, we had this question last year when we were doing on the TNT. We were doing like a guest thing. See, somebody bring up something and see if you knew what it meant. And the word was, what's RG? What does RG stand for? And it simply means radio guide, radio guide. And it was originally a military specification for coaxial cable. Starting in 1930s, whoa, we're going back there, starting in the 1930s. So what do all the numbers mean? RG6, RG8, RG58, and all of those, and so on and so on. The number is just the page in a book. RG1 was the first page. And obviously, it wasn't a very successful cable design. RG6, the sixth page, was widely successful, mostly in CATV, broadband cable. These days is RG6. So we know a lot of us use the RG8 or the RG58. If that's all it refers to is an old page in a book, and they just kept those numbers rolling. So it's radio guide is what RG stands for. It's good to know. Ah, let's see. Pete has something there on a jury. Here we go. Pete, what does it say? It's the same word in French and English, J-U-R-Y, jury. How about that? It's the same word in both languages. Do you have anything else you want to add to that, Pete? I'm letting it drop.
Yeah, it's the same word, same pronunciation, the jury, and it's spelled the same as well. So there you go. That's a kind of an easy one. Back to you, Michael.
I think with a lot of us, English is a second language, even though it's the only one we may know. English is made up of so many languages, so many fragments from everything from the Greek and the Latin all the way to God knows. We pick up words as we go along. I hear new terms on the news media, which makes me, what are they saying now? They come up with new terms, or they just take them out of the air. English is a very fluid, living language. Here's another one. Why hams end a QSO with dit-dit? In the old days, every time a train left the station, now we're talking about the old steam engines, it would sound two short blasts from its whistle, warning everyone that it was moving out. The old telegraph operators, having been exposed to this practice, picked it up and would send two dits at the end of each telegraph message, which meant goodbye. So ham radio CW operators adopted the practice. It is still used worldwide today. That's interesting right there. The old railroad days definitely would infiltrate into the CW world. I've got one here from a fellow named Eric, which is K1NUN. He writes, when I was first licensed in the early 1960s, we ended our CW conversation with dit, 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 shave and a haircut. Remember that? Shave and a haircut? I remember that. To which the other station would reply, dit, dit, which was two bits. The station would send two dits. And this would go on the Internet. I wonder if Gordon remembers any of this. It says here, mainly among young teenagers, so I guess teenagers would have been Gordon's time, they might continue for several minutes. Over time, the back-and-forth terminal handshake shortened just to dit-dit. Also about that time, sometime inside of somebody called CQ, one would just go dit-dit-dit-dit over and over on a frequency. Remember, we were crystal-controlled in the novice bands while tuning the receiver. Listening to anyone who sent a synchronized dit after enough back and forth to ensure proper synchronization, one of the stations would send QRZ with a question mark so as to really ask who was calling me. Thus, dit also began a QSO in some cases. Fortunately, this custom died within a very few years as the rules changed and more of us could use transceivers that put out the right frequency and did not have to be tuned and search for responders. And that's my story, and I'm living with it. Okay, this is KD0CDQ on a TNT tonight on the SCARS network doing some origins of ham. Anyone have any questions? Come on aboard now, please. Okay, I have some more stuff on 50-ohm cable. Okay, another thing which might have led to 50-ohm cable is that if you take a reasonable-sized center conductor and put an insulator around that and then put a shield around that and chose all the dimensions so that they are convenient and mechanically good, looking good, then the impedance would come out at about 50 ohms. In order to raise the impedance, the center conductor diameter needed to be tiny with respect to the overall cable size. And in order to lower the impedance, the thickness of the insulation between the inner conductor and the shield must be made very thin. Since all coax that looks good mechanically happens to come out close to 50 ohms anyway, there's a natural tendency to standardize at exactly 50 ohms. Okay, that again came from I don't know where that came from because I skipped over some information. There was so much information as why we use 50 ohms cable. I just had to find something that was interesting. A lot of it was kind of technical, and I didn't want to drag us down too much into technical stuff, unless you all want to. If anybody wants to say anything about 50-ohm cable as to why we use it, go ahead now. Okay, I know there's a station trying to come in. I'm sorry, it's a little broken up. Could you try it again? I believe you're coming from Central Florida on 2 meters, are you? Okay, I'm going to go on. I'm going to go on with the origins of CQ and SOS. This is a good topic. You know, many people just know the SOS. They never realized that CQ had an important play in the early days of ham radio, of amateur radio, or even the full paid guys. And here's the origins from the Internet. It says on page 4 of Borslag's famous Sea Rescues, formerly titled SOS to the Rescue, by 1904, a number of ships in the transatlantic trade were equipped with wireless telegraph. The British operators were nearly all landline telegraphers who had left railroad or post office keys to go to sea in the newly opened field. They brought along with them not only their Morse code, but also many of their telegraph abbreviations and signals. One was a general call, CQ, which had been used to attract attention of all operators along the wire. It preceded the time signal in the morning at 10 o'clock in the morning. There'd be a time signal, and also all notices in general importance. So they would say CQ, and then they would do their message. And again, it looks like at 10 o'clock every morning, they would just come out aboard with the CQ, kind of like on a connect, just to make sure everything was working, I would say. CQ went to sea and became a general call to all ships. A complete telegrapher later said, early in 1904, the Marconi Company, realizing the desirability of some universal distress signal, filled the need by using the following general order. They put this order out. It has been brought to our notice that the call CQ, all stations, while being satisfactory for general purposes, does not sufficiently express the urgency required in a signal of distress. Okay, therefore, on and after February 1st, 1904, the call to be given by ships in distress or in any way requiring assistance shall become CQD. So CQD would be called if there was any need of assistance. To me, this implies that prior to the 1st of February 1904, some ships did use CQ as a distress call, and possibly their calls for help didn't draw the needed attention. This was before the twice per hour silent period was created on 600 meters. It was pure bedlam, and CQ would have gone unheeded. See, there's another little piece of information, that twice per hour there was a silent period prior to 1904, around that period of time. Interesting. So they went to CQD for distress, to make people's ears just jump up a little bit more. Anybody have any comments about that as I let it drop? This is KD0CDQ, Mike here. Okay, here I am in Kansas, on the suburbs of Kansas City. And I know you people in the East are looking forward to the snowstorm, I presume, that we were hit with. We had a double blast. We received like a 2-inch storm to get us started, and then followed up with the next 6 inches to give us 8. It was a beautiful thing to view, but it wasn't a beautiful thing to you if you had to drive in it. So it's heading east, I believe, the storm. It's past us here. Although we have more snow on the way, they tell us possibly Friday, and then again on Sunday. So as things go from west to east in this wonderful country of ours, in this wonderful continent of ours, I would say the East Coast is going to have a little bit of a blast of snow coming your way. Anyway, let's go back to this telegraphic codes of Morse and men. The fellow Kenneth Brown, G0PSW, writes this little history. And also, I have seen note that there are some people who would like to see some information on the ham test, like on a technician's test. They would like to see some historical questions on there as well for hams to know. That's an interesting subject to put a little history on the test. Might not hurt to put one or two questions on there, but we don't have that at the present time. So let's look at some history here of ham radio. Let's try to make it interesting. Does anyone know when the first telegraph message is thought to have been sent between what cities? Anybody know when the first telegraph signals were sent and between what cities that was?
VE2XPL.
Go ahead, VE2XPL.
Well, I really can't guess the time frame. I'm going to guess sometime in the late 1800s. And I'm going to say New York and, let's say, Chicago. But strictly a guess. So back to you.
It's a good guess. The time is pretty close and the place is pretty close. But, see, I already have it written down here, so that makes me a professional here. It makes me the pro with the answer. I had no idea where the first message was sent, nor the year. You know, you just hear that it happened way back when in the Dark Ages. But here it is. The first line telegraph message is thought to have been sent from Washington, D.C., to Baltimore. That's only about 40-mile distance from Washington to Baltimore in May 1844. So 1844 by Samuel Finley Brzee Morse. We know him as Sam Morse. And he is said to have tapped out this message, "What God has wrath." It's W-R-O-U-G-H-T. It's a wonder. "What God has wrath" is what he sent, using a code of interrupted signals which he and his associate Alfred Vail had developed some years earlier. So the interrupted signals would be what we call CW. So 1844 between Washington and Baltimore, and it was between Morse and his ally, his associate Vail, V-A-I-L, like Vail, Colorado. After this momentous achievement, and following the founding of Western Union in 1856, coast-to-coast telegraph lines were quickly installed, and it then became commercially possible to send and receive telegraph traffic by line. Since then, and with an eye on faster speed of transmissions and higher accuracy, newspapers, railroads, and post offices made great use of the telegraph to provide their customers with speedy, economic, personal, and commercial communications. This also paved the way for communicating traffic by radio from the late 1890s following successful experiments by Marconi. Here comes Marconi in 1890s. One way to speed the flow of traffic was to operate an agreed set of short codes to replace the well-known sentences or phrases, but at the time there was no common national or international standard. They had no standards at that time. The first of many conferences to discuss and try to resolve this issue was held in the U.S. in April 1857 and culminated with the release of the National Telegraphic Review and Operator's Guide. So in the mid-1850s, they came up with codes to use that would shorten, so they didn't have to use sentences. They could just use different abbreviations. This guide made the first authentic reference to the well-known greeting 73. At that time, meaning love and kisses. Oh, boy, it means love and kisses originally. Later editions kept this definition, but as time went by, the meaning of 73 changed from a Valentine type of greeting to a vague sign of operator's fraternalism. Western Union, 1859, set up the standard 92 code, replacing common sentences and phrases with selected numbers between 1 and 92. The message was telegraphed to a distant station. At the distant end, the numbers were decoded and a plain language version was delivered to the recipient. So instead of doing full sentences, they just used the standard 92 codes, each number meaning a certain group of words or phraseology, shall we say. The change of 73 yet again was very flowerly accepted in comments from 1859 to 1900 that many telegraph manuals show variations of the meaning. Each major telegraph and railroad company had its own distinctive telegraphic codes. Since there was no agreed standard, all these were different, and as a consequence, there was much confusion in communication with different networks. Kind of like Motorola has their own plan and, you know, all of this. And
all right, looks like Mike's timed out. We'll have a short interlude while he untimes out and comes back in. A very interesting topic indeed, Michael. I especially like the history of CW. I think that's really interesting because it seems to me that CW was actually the first real email, you know, capabilities of sending messages through wires from one side of the country to the other, much like we do with the internet now. Of course, you know, it's a little bit fancier and a little bit more newfangled than it was back in the old days, but CW was really the first email, and interestingly, South Cars is organizing a Morse code class starting in a few weeks, which I encourage all of you to participate in, as many of you as possible. I think it's going to be very interesting, but we're all communicating via email to get all the information out regarding this CW class, which could really be considered the first email. So there you go, full circle. Back to you, Michael. I see you're back.
Yes, as they say, more things change, the more they stay the same. I don't know if any of you have looked in your QST magazine for February, which has arrived to most places. They're showing some very interesting forward-moving articles, which I was planning on getting into at the end here. But interesting thing about CW, as I mentioned another time on the air, my club here in Kansas, we were going to have technician classes, but we conflicted with some other groups that were very successful, so we decided not to have a technician class this month. Instead, on 1 week's notice, we decided, let's do CW. We had the firehouse room, you know, we had everything set up, we had everybody planning to come, so we just put the word out, let's do CW classes instead. Who wants to do that? And don't you know that so many people emailed and whatever in that we had the room was full. It can only take about maybe 17 people maximum in this training room, and it filled immediately. So the interest is there for CW, people wanting to learn. And as you mentioned, Pete, we here on South Cars, we're going to start CW classes via Echolink starting on the 30th of this month, 30th of January. It'll be at 7 p.m. Eastern Time on this station that you're on right now, and the 96140 if you're Echolink, or 9614 if you're on IRLP. We're going to start it right here, and you do have to register because we do have some materials that we would like you to get through the internet. That's all free. We don't charge anything, but there's materials available to you, but we definitely need to know who you are. So you have to register so we can send information to you, and so Gordon, KY6V, Victor, he will be giving the class for us. So, as you can see, CW does have its place. And it's also mentioned in some articles in the QST when they're talking about the new move to all this new stuff. But CW hangs in there. It's not going to go away. Isn't that a sweet thing? I know I've been practicing on the, LOCW? There's a website that I hammer away on each day. So I try to practice CW. I try to learn it. It comes slow for me, but, you know, we got nothing but time. Okay, I'm going to let it drop, and then I'm going to start on a little more information that I have here on code, CW, where it all came from. This is KD0CDQ, Mike, letting it drop. Anybody would like to say anything, come on aboard. This is KD0CDQ. As we said, when they tried to standardize everything, we even had two different CW alphabets. We had the American alphabet, the Continental alphabet, which was European alphabet, and different companies had different codes. We had the standard 92 codes, but different railroads or telegraph companies would have their own interpretations of it. This combined with a multiplicity of telegraphic codes causing confusion and made communication with and between U.S. established participants difficult. In the U.S. in 1908, there was a Dodger's manual that gives today's definition of 73 as best regards. Other Dodge numbers were 88 for love and kisses, 55 lots of success, 99 get lost, probably unofficial. Also in 1908, the British Post Office, despairing the action, agreed on an international code of abbreviations, issued its own list of two-letter abbreviations intended to be used on the British coast stations and ships. So there you go. And the British Postal Service got involved. And here are some abbreviations which we are not used to at all. Maybe some of you that have been around with ham for a long time remember some of these, but I'm talking about the early 1900s. So you only would have read about it or heard about it, but I don't know that you would actually have used them. There was a list published in the MPG's Instructions to Wireless Operationists, including abbreviations from RA to RZ, okay, R codes, and then SA to SF. The next International Radio Telegraphic Convention, held in London in 1912, way back there in 1912, adopted and extended the GPO abbreviations. That's the general group. Q was added to the first letter, and so the Q code was born. So it was born in 1912. They started putting Qs in the front. The new code now ran like QRA to QRZ and QSA to QSX. On July 1st, 1913, the Q code finally became an official international informational code, updated as changing circumstances demand to include new codes related to such matters as aviation and maritime. Sometime later came the Z code, running in parallel with the Q codes. The origin as a company of codes of cable and wireless with applications limited, in the main, the high-speed machine Morse operators at speeds of typically 120 words per minute, widely used by many countries, including Germany, the Q codes and the Z codes continued in use throughout the war. We're talking about World War I here. After the war, high-speed Morse became less widely used and was replaced by other forms of traffic communications. And then along came RTTY, the facsimile. The Z code, therefore, gradually went out of fashion and slowly disappeared. Examples of the Z code include ZAA, you are not observing circuit discipline, ZAN, we can receive absolutely nothing, and ZST, send slips twice, and ZAP, acknowledgement please, and there were lots of others. This is KD0CDQ, letting it drop. Now we're getting into more modern times. Operating during the 1930s and 40s, okay, 1930s and 40s, so some of us were just coming out of the cradle, at the same time as the Z and Q codes was the X code. Oh, no, now they threw the X code in. Then in use by European military services as a wireless telegraph code. This consisted of letters X followed by a number. For example, X34 meant your Morse is bad. X50, your Morse is good. X100 was an affirmation. And then like X112 was interrogate. And then X279, what is the strength of my signal? And it goes on and on, with starting with an X with numbers behind it. The X code continued in use with the forces until 1942. Then at the assistance of the U.S. military, it was replaced by the Q codes. You can see in 1942, because, again, December 7, 1941, got the U.S. involved in the World War. So in 1942, the U.S. military insisted on using Q codes, and because we were paying a lot of the bills, I guess they converted over from the X codes to the Q codes. However, the odd X code still can be heard from veteran telegraphers even now, but not very often. So the Q code became the standard international military and civil telegraphic letter code used in CW communications, sometimes incorrectly, even as R/T. Published an operator's manual, there were separate sections available to deal with various areas of communications. Some less well-known examples are the Q codes used by base stations of the British Army, including QAU, followed by QHU, which meant, I am waterlogged, I am about to jettison fuel, or AS5 generally followed. Even less well-known is QGG. QGG means send the pony by the next train. I think George would like that. Send the pony by the next train, GQQ. All right. If they want to use that, I guess it worked well. Widely used by radio amateurs operating CW today's codes, Q codes, are highly different meanings, but still very similar to the 1912 codes. One of the greatest benefits of using the Q code is the pleasure of being able to communicate with overseas operators who may not be fluent in the English language. In conclusion, it is a sad fact. There will be no successor to the Q codes. No longer is the Morse code taught in the Royal Navy, they say. Oh, the Royal Navy gave it up. Data stream transmissions have displaced Morse and taken over everyday communication, such as the march of time. Now this came from Pat Hawkins, Hooker, a G3VA, who wrote this, along with a Peter Broom, G5DQ. And they were the ones that put this information together on that. An interesting thing, I am noticing, it's not very fluent, but I'm noticing a little bit of CW on TV. Has anybody noticed any TV programs with CW being used in it? I'm letting it drop. This is KD0CDQ. By recently, I mean one was in 2010 and one was just now in 2011. In 2010, I was watching the NCIS, which is a very popular show, Naval Intelligence, you know, NCSI, they had a tractor trailer that was supposedly full of drugs, and they were supposedly trying to foil the thugs by delivering this truck to the point where it had to be, and then they would catch them. Well, while they were driving the truck, the tractor trailer, he was giving with his brake lights Morse code. So the cars that were following could know all as well, and that he was getting close to the site where he had to make the drop. So he was using Morse code with the brake lights. That was cool. And, of course, they made like the fellows actually knew what it was saying. I couldn't tell, you know, what they were doing there. But they used the brake lights on a tractor trailer to give signals to a car way back behind. All was well. We're getting close to the scene, all that stuff. And then just last week, I'm going to say, I was watching a program, and it's another one of these semi-comedy adventurous things that are on television. I can't bring up the name, although I do tend to watch it. These fellows were being held hostage, and they were dressed in the assault uniforms that the thugs had used, and they were standing in front of a window. The idea was they wanted the FBI from another building, sharpshooters, to shoot the hostages and make a big scene out of it because they were dressed in the clothing that the thugs had been wearing. Well, one of the fellows who was standing in the window and the FBI was getting ready, he was getting ready to tell the sharpshooters, take them out. He had a flashlight. And with this little flashlight, here he goes. He gives out Morse code. And again, the FBI agent was supposedly able to read it. I'm going to let it drop and come back. This is KD0CDQ. I think I'm back on the air again. I might have run long there. But what was neat was that in these little soliloquies that are doing, little things doing on TV, they are showing some Morse code use. And what is interesting, they're showing that federal agents know Morse code. So it may be so. We may have FBI, CIA, Naval Intelligence. We may have people like that who are still learning Morse code and not only learning it but able to read it. And maybe we'll see more of this in 2011. Keep your eyes open. Keep your eyes peeled. And if you see any of that here on the TNT on a Thursday night, I mentioned that I saw a program where they're using a CW. So it's interesting. It's kind of colorful. It's colorful because it's totally unexpected. And everybody kind of thinks it's kind of like a miracle. CW is kind of a miracle to many folks. So it's just basically a language. But it's a language, if you don't use it, you lose it. So that's why I see that in the QST magazine, and I see in various places, like on South Cars, there's going to be CW classes available. I'm going to refer to an article that I have here in the February issue of QST. On page 96 in the op-ed section is Evolve or Die. I'm going to recommend this Evolve or Die article. You may want to read it. It's by Randy Ross, KI4ZJI. he alludes to, would we be able to communicate over the internet as hams if we had lost telecommunications in your area? In other words, Aries and Races, could we still get into the internet? Interesting article. It led me to email him. I did email to Randy and emailed back to me. I wanted to know what he was referring to, and he gave me some information. What he was basically speaking about in his article, but he didn't mention it. He kind of gave you a tickler, you know, he gave you a tickler. He was talking about the D-Star, the ICOM D-Star, where you can, through your internet, through your handheld, if you have D-Star, you're able to get on the internet. Now, I don't have D-Star, but I do have a friend who does, and I'm going to have to ask him, how does this thing work? Because that's one method of getting on the internet with your handheld, with D-Star, and of course it also has a GPS in it, so it can be a useful tool. He also, in his email to me, mentioned a couple of other things that they're looking at, some new technology that they're watching, technology that is presently being used in the cell phone industry. You know, people don't even realize that they have ham radios in their hand. They think they're using some kind of very new technology. But to me, all they're using is handhelds and bouncing off a repeater. Don't you look at it that way, guys? Do any of you feel that all these cell phones we see around, did we ever get the feel that we're just going back to ham radio? Anybody have a comment on that? This is KD0CDQ.
Well, it is very similar. V2XBL here, a quick interruption, but it is very similar. You know, when we used to play with walkie-talkies as kids, ham radio, cell phones, CBs, oh my God, there's a bad word, CBs. It's all communications and it's all good. VOIP, communications. We're all talking to each other. The important thing is that we communicate. I don't think that the means for communicating really matters as long as you can get your message out there. But they're all very valid means of communication. And if it works and it serves your purpose, then there you go. That's all my two cents. Anybody else who wants to jump in, feel free to do so. Back to KD0ZDQ.
Yes, that's something we need to look at, and I do notice that a few high schools in the country are having ham classes. They actually have clubs within the high school. I know there's one here in my own county that has just started a ham club for high school students, and I was reading in QST that there is a little bit of a movement going on in the country where it's up to the teachers. You got to run into a teacher, mainly a science teacher, who's trying to find something to energize the kids and keep them interested. And they're using ham radio as one of the attractors to get kids together and have them do something together and do something with their hands, build something, do something. I think that's a neat idea. I'd like to see that grow some more. Another article in the QST in February in the Eclectic Technology, they're talking about Windows 7. They're saying, take the plunge at Windows 7. The author, who is WB8IMY, the author says here that he has checked out on Windows 7 things like the Write Log, the Ham Radio Deluxe, the DigiPan, the WSPR, WSJR, and Power SDR, and all different systems. He's tried them out on Windows, and they seem to work. They're working for him. So although there are some kinks in Windows 7, it seems that ham radio, it may be okay. I do understand that some people on Echolink may be having some trouble on Windows 7. I have heard this. I don't know if any of you have had that problem or have friends. Anybody have any comments about anybody on Windows 7 having any trouble with Echolink?
X-Ray Papa Lima.
Go ahead, X-Ray Papa Lima.
Yeah, personally haven't had problems. Although I'm having a machine at work completely redone, I was planning on throwing Echolink on there anyway, so I was going to give it a shot. As far as I'm concerned, though, 7 is much more stable than Vista, depending on the applications, of course. The machines we use are very used in high graphic environments, and they need to perform. So Vista was causing a lot of problems with various interfaces and drivers, which seems a lot of those issues seem to have been solved with 7. But I know that I'll be able to tell you more in about a month or so. You can ask me the question again. I don't know if anybody else has had it. It was kind of quiet out there, so I don't know if anybody else has had any experiences. But do you know specifically what those problems, what might have been, or is it just sort of some general information floating around that it's incompatible? Back to you, Michael.
KY6V was discussing with somebody a number of weeks ago that they were having trouble with their Windows 7 and Echo Link. It might have just been other problems, but it was on their Windows 7 that they were having that problem. And what it wasn't stable for them for some reason. But I think a lot of it has to do with our protections that we have on our computers, whatever you want to call them, different suites that we have. I know I do have a fellow in my club, the vice president. He's not able to use Echo Link, and I don't know what to tell him. He cannot seem to get it to operate on his computer. And I haven't gone to his home and sat down with him, but he still had the problem this Saturday. He still can't get through his firewall. I told him, drop all your firewalls. Maybe, Pete, that might be the advice that I gave him. I told him, drop all your firewalls and then install the Echo Link, because he already has his approval of that he is a ham radio operator. He's got all that. But he just can't get it to operate. So do you think that was a good idea for me to tell him momentarily to drop his firewalls and then install it and bring him back aboard? Would that help him maybe?
Six, Victor.
Oh, please, yes, Gordon, because you did have an issue with somebody with Windows 7. Please go ahead.
Well, I don't want to upcut our executive producer here. You want to go ahead, Pete, and I'll come in behind you. KY6B.
Yeah, no, you know a whole lot about more about this than I do, Gordon. But I was going to mention firewalls might be one issue, and then in the text box we also have KB1RXA mentions port forwarding. So, and I'll also take this opportunity to plug the podcast because KY6V gave two incredible presentations last year, which we called Echo Link 101 and 102. So I encourage you guys to go to the waveguides.ca website. There's a link right on the voip.southcars.com page. And check out those two podcasts if you want to know everything you need to know about configuring. But go ahead, Gordon, KY6V, you have the floor.
Well, thank you very much, Pete. KY6V here, and hi, Chris. Port forwarding and firewall issues I consider in one basket. Call-outs are really one and the same. It's been my experience, to answer your question on Windows 7, Mike. I've been running it now about 6 months, or maybe a little better than that. I absolutely love it. It rolls back to some extent to XP Pro that I was very comfortable with. It takes care of an awful lot of problems that Vista produced. When Windows 7 first came out, there was a compatibility problem with drivers and what have you not being updated fast enough, but that's all taken care of itself in time. As far as Echo Link and Windows 7, I'll tell you where the one problem is, and the only problem that I have noticed, and that is occasionally you will lose your sound. Be it your incoming sound to your speakers or your microphone sound going out to the world. The quickest way to get around that problem is to close out your Echo Link program. Don't reboot the whole computer. Just close out the Echo Link program and bring it back up, and you will have sound. The problem is in the software of Echo Link and the construction of Windows 7, there are times, and you can't predict this, that Echo Link loses sight within the program of who the default sound device is. And when that happens, you've lost it. Rebooting the system and coming back, and that takes very little time, clears the issue, and Echo Link now finds out who it's supposed to be talking to. That's the only problem that I know on Echo Link on Windows 7 at this point. Now, as far as your friend is concerned, firewall issues are one of the primary issues that a new enrollee in the Echo Link program will find. There's many issues that are involved. It could be in their computer. It is most likely and normally in their router if they're using a router. And furthermore, if they're using a modem such as a DSL modem, that has a built-in router. It also has a built-in DHCP server that all can just drive you nuts. So I'd be very happy to help this gentleman if he has some communication other than EchoLink, like Skype. Maybe I can talk him through it, or there's an awful lot of people on this server that are very knowledgeable in this area, Mike. Back to you, sir, from KY6B.
Gordon, thank you so much for that information. I was writing down, as you were saying items, I was writing them down. And Dell, the fellow that's having trouble with it, he's quite active fellow in our club, and he's quite active in the ham community. But this has been going on for a number of weeks now that he can't get aboard. I will ask him. I'll be seeing him probably Saturday morning, and I'll ask him if he's interested and if he has Skype. He's an insurance agent. He has his own business, so he has his days are kind of open. Thank you, Gordon. I'll bring that up to him, and I'll see if he wants to make contact with you. But getting back to all of this, even though we looked at the origins of ham tonight, and I referred to two articles in the QST in February 2011, see, it's all continuous. The things of old and the things today, it's a continuous story. It's probably a bumpy road. It's not smooth. Like, our planet may look smooth from outer space, but when you get down here, you see it's kind of bumpy. The ham saga continues, shall we say. It continues. I was even seeing there was an article on the ARRL newsletter that came out today saying that the FCC was looking negative towards picking up the A series. They wanted to pick up Alpha as another series of call signs for vanity, and it looks like the FCC is not interested. That's okay. We'll keep on going. See, it's a bumpy road, but it continues. We never let up. We never give up. This is the area of science, the electronic science. It's so important. Many of us that do ham radio for fun, but a lot of people that are listening in right now are probably involved very heavily in electronics. It's just their thing. And this is just our hobby. It's just a hobby, but it sure can get consuming. Well, if anybody has any comments they want to make, we've been on the air for just a hair over an hour. I'm looking at it that it's just 2:03 Zulu. And for me here, it's 8 p.m., and for you on the East Coast and such, it's 9. If anybody wants to make a comment, go right ahead. But soon I'm going to move away from this. This is KD0CDQ on the TNT. We're doing the SCARS network tonight, but we're doing Origins of Ham. If anybody has a comment, please come aboard now.
Mike, back to you. I've got a couple of quick parting comments if you have time. If not, we'll parley them later. Go ahead, sir.
Gordon, I'm sure we'd all love to hear what you have. Please go right ahead with that. I'm listening here on this end.
All right, thank you. I'll make it short here. Interesting story of that. You know, a lot of us through the years have got to the habit of using that. We use it on our horn. When we see a friend driving by, we go, did-did-did-did-did. Or if you come to visit a ham friend and you come up to the front door and they know you're coming, and at least hopefully know you're coming. You don't use the doorbell, you know, because ding-dong like Avon. You just knock on the front door. You go, did-did-did-did-did. And as far as the end of transmissions are concerned, standard practice is it's an AR, an A and an R, to dad, to dad it, to send it back to a station for his next transmission. That's at the end of your transmission, at the end of your call. Now, when you are taking your last transmission, and you will not be back, you send an SK, and that's did-did-did, da-da-da. Means I will not be back. This is the ending, last word from me. And then as you said, and very eloquently, if you want to put a little flair into that, you send an SK with an I. Did-da-da-da, dit-dit, which goes back to the old time saying goodbye. Go ahead, Mike, KY6B.
As the youngsters would say, very cool, Gordon. So any of you that are listening in would like to sharpen your CW skills or just do it for the first time or whatever, come on aboard. I know Gordon has stimulated me that I am spending at least 15 minutes a day on the internet on that website that I mentioned where I'm practicing Morse code. I did this earlier and I let it drop, you know, and I'm doing it again. And so Gordon is energizing me and hopefully others to get involved in Morse code. And the only thing I heard from the fellows that are taking the class at the local fire station in CW, they said they don't have time to do the homework. Well, I don't think the instructor shouldn't. It's not homework. It should be fun work. I don't know what approach they gave them, but if they don't have time to spend 15 minutes a day just popping out practice, they're not really serious. So it's not really homework. It should be fun work. And that's the way I would look at it. I have fun with it. I have fun with it. It's. I'm telling you, Gordon, it's a killer. I have trouble. I don't know if it's my ears. I have trouble sometimes picking up the dits and the dats. But I'm working at it. I'm not going to give up. I keep working letter by letter, joining the letters together, doing groups. I'm working at it, Gordon. And that's what I'd recommend to any of you. Come on down there on the 30th of January. But, of course, register first so you get some information and know what you're doing. Come on and try that class. On the last Sunday, probably the last Sunday of the month. We'll start there. We're only going to have like four sessions, but it may get you off the ground. It may push you off from the coast, you know, get you going. And I really appreciate that Gordon, KY6 Victor, is going to give these classes. I appreciate it. And when the local club said they were going to give the classes, I didn't respond to it because, no, I'm taking my class from Gordon. I think I can learn better from Gordon. What they were going to do at the club was have three instructors. And I thought, uh-oh, how can you have three chiefs? But it didn't sound right to me, so I'm glad that they got a full house, and I hope it works out, and I hope the homework isn't going to bog anybody down. But it's good. CW is a good thing. It's something to keep messing with. Anybody have a comment about anything this evening or about CW or about the classes at the end of the month? Come on aboard and let us know, because we're going to leave here soon. This is KD0CDQ. Okay, as they say, it's been real. And as I said earlier, there's a book club in my house right now. My wife has her friends downstairs, and I know they got good snacks. I put coffee on, and I saw all the cake getting baked today and looking good. See, I'm home. I work in a high school, and with the snow we're having, we're on weather alert, so we didn't have any school today, and we missed 2 days last week. I know you guys in Florida don't know what we're talking about with snow. But last week we lost Monday and Tuesday to the snow. And then this week, Monday and Tuesday was Martin Luther King here in Kansas. We get 2 days off of Martin Luther King. I think they're making up for the bad time when they didn't have time off of Martin Luther King. So we get Monday and Tuesday off, and don't you know, Thursday, here comes the snow. So we've had 1 day of school this week. We're going to have school again tomorrow, 2 days. So it's been kind of a run. I'm enjoying the time off. I'm getting used to it. But I know I got to get back to the five-day week again. It's be the same next week. We'll be back on the roll. But you guys in Florida, just snuggle up. Oh, by the way, the weatherman the other day here in Kansas said there's only one state that does not have snow on the ground. And then he broke to a commercial break, and he came back and said, well, have you all had a chance to figure what state of the 50 does not have snow on the ground? Because most of us, oh, Hawaii. It was Florida. Hawaii had snow in the mountains. So the only state of the 50 that did not have snow on the ground last week was Florida. I thought that was cool. It tricked me. Okay, this is KD0CDQ, Mike here in the Kansas City environs, about 23 miles southwest of Kansas City out here in Kansas. And I'm going to join my friends downstairs and have some dessert. And I didn't read the book. I'm a spouse of the book club, shall we say. I just come for the snacks. So if anybody has any comments, come on now. Come on on board. It's all yours. This is KD0CDQ. Pete, thank you. Thank you as well. I'm going to turn it over to Pete up there in sunny, it must be sunny in Quebec because it's Canada after all. By the way, I saw a railroad video today, and it was all Canadian railroad. Boy, it's beautiful up there, and it was all snow-covered scenes of different trains in different parts of the country. I really enjoyed that. If you'd like me to forward it to you, I will, Pete, if you'd like to see that. This is KD0CDQ.
No, thank you, Michael. Thank you for being there. Very much appreciated. Yeah, if you could forward that to me, I'd be happy to have a look at that. Indeed, there's a huge train heritage here, very much part of our history, and I'm sure that a lot of those images probably come from out west, which is, you know, the Rocky Mountain Express that's still going through today on some of these bridges that were built over valleys, bridges that are built out of wood that will, you know, go up hundreds of feet in the air. It's quite impressive. But that being said, thanks for being there. I very much appreciate your help tonight. The topic was very, very interesting. I'm sure that all of our listeners enjoyed it as well. I'd like to thank everybody who was here with us live tonight. Almost 30 stations that connected at one time or another. Also, thanks to those who are joining us via podcast. Check us out at VOIP.SouthCars.com, and there's a link to the podcast on the left, or you could access the podcast directly, waveguides.ca. So thanks again for being there. 7-3s to all, and I'll pass it back to Michael, and you can tie the ribbons on it. From V2XBL in Montreal, back to Net Control.
KP, thank you for the opportunity this evening. Actually, you inspired this topic. A number of weeks ago, we were discussing topics, and somehow the origins of ham popped in my mind from something you said. So you're the one that encouraged me to hunt on the Internet to find this information. And it's interesting. We feed off of one another, you know? And of course, Gordon's the big fish, though. He's the one that really gets us thinking, like about the Morse code and the classes, the tech, the general, and the extra that we did last year. He's the motivator. He's the big chief, the big fish, I guess, in the pond here. And I appreciate his being there. And, Pete, I appreciate you. I appreciate you, how you inspire us to keep us going. And you give me ideas for things to do. And I'm listening for ideas of what to do next month. Okay, I am finished here. It's been an hour and 15. It's been my pleasure. After shoveling snow three times today, don't you know, the only time my back didn't hurt was when I was talking on the radio here. The rest of the evening, I'm as stiff as a board. Three times is too much for an old man to do snow in a day. But that's it. It's all clear now. So good night, everyone, and God bless, and I'll be listening next to Thursday night, if not sooner. This is KD0CDQ, my final.
Well, again, thanks to everyone for being there. As I forgot to mention, next week on the 27th will be our habitual open forum roundtable rag chew, where we throw around different topics and everybody gives their 2 cents on said topics. Everybody brings something interesting to the table. So we got a nice, interesting panel lined up. And David, KD8HQU, David in Michigan, will be our host. So we look forward to that. And we hope that we will all see you there in great numbers. So I reiterate Michael's comments. Thanks to everyone for being there, and we'll talk to you all next week. This is V2XBL in Montreal. You've been listening to Michael, KD0CDQ, who is our host tonight on the TNT Open Forum, home of the Waveguides podcast. 7-3s, V2XBL in Montreal, going clear.